journey down a corridor of time with me to the year 1981, a new decade, not long into the decade of the 80s. I was a young boy, maybe 8 years old. I don't know the year. I know how old I was in that year. I can do math. But I was a prisoner at the Eastridge Presbyterian Church daycare. Incarcerated, not by my own choice, but by the will of my parents. It wasn't that bad. But there was a man, one of our caregivers, and in daycare you always called everybody Mr. in their first name, and we'll call him Bob. Mr. Bob was a man that I did not admire. Mr. Bob was a man who did not warrant, at least in my little self, my admiration, my attentiveness, my swift and adherent obedience. And so Mr. Bob one day, and what I'm about to tell you, I'm not proud of any of these things. I'm making a point. I'm not condoning this behavior. Kids, this was a wicked thing for me to do. But Mr. Bob said, "All right, guys, it's time to clean up." It was after lunch. "It's time to get ready for the next activity. Let's everybody throw your chairs under the table." So I did. I picked up my chair and I gave literal, specific, to the T obedience to Bob. And I took my chair and I threw it under the table and making a loud crashing noise into other chairs under the table. And I didn't just throw mine, I threw others. He said to throw the chairs under the table. I was just obeying him, literally. He didn't think it was cute. I had to go see the director of the program. We'll call her Mrs. Frown. Because this was the face that she wore often when she looked at me. The end. Now, I did not die, but maybe I should have. And I certainly was afraid enough to, but that dynamic of me offering word for word obedience to what Mr. Bob said, but in my heart, underneath, I completely disregarded his intention because I had completely disregarded him. I think it's valuable to note when we come to a passage that deals with Jesus' activity on the Sabbath, what we now call the Lord's Day. It got switched over when Christians in the first century recognized that a new world had begun with the resurrection of their Lord. They began to meet on the first day of the week as the Lord's Day. When we're talking about practices like these, as we noted when we've talked about tithing in the past and other religious things that adherents to Jesus tend to want to care about and tend to want to practice, it's very important as a beginning point to note that Jesus' anger is aimed at the most ardent Sabbath keepers. Jesus' anger is aimed at the most ardent, the most tenacious, the most enthusiastic Sabbath keepers. Mark, as we're looking at through this Lenten series, we're walking with Jesus through the Gospel of Mark, where there are a number of succinct actions by Jesus, not a whole lot of teaching, but we're seeing him in these episodes, and episode after episode, we see him on the Sabbath day, almost as if he is purposefully trying to create a crisis for the religious leaders in Israel. He keeps doing things on the Sabbath that provoke their ire. And he aims his anger at those who are the guardians of righteousness in Israel. He looks around at them in anger and is deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. I'm hoping that as we look at this, we can learn a couple of things ourselves. One, is we can use this episode here in the end of chapter 2 and in chapter 3, we can use it as kind of an x-ray. You know, x-rays are strong devices that help you see beneath the surface, below the skin, what's really going on. A kind of MRI for the soul we can use these episodes as. And they can warn us of dangers. When we look at these Pharisees and the way they're dealing with Jesus, the first thing I'd warn you of is beware if you find yourself to become the moral policeman of everyone around you. Beware if you find yourself becoming a moral policeman for everyone around you. One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and as his disciples walked along, they began to pick some heads of grain. They're out in the field. And the Pharisees said to him, "Look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" Raising the very obvious question of, did they have binoculars? I'm serious. Did you think they had binoculars? They didn't have binoculars! I'm going to fill you in. I've done exhaustive first century research. There were no binoculars. So they were there. They were spying him out. They were watching him. When he walks into the synagogue, there was a man there with a shriveled hand, presumably staged this showdown. The Pharisees had put a man with shriveled hand there on the Sabbath. He's a pawn in their game. They know that Jesus is a bleeding heart liberal, wants to heal people with shriveled hands. And so they're looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. Do you see? These Pharisees, these religious people, we should identify with them in a lot of ways because they take God seriously, they take his laws seriously, they're trying to be really good. We should find some resonance there. But they've become policemen. They're looking out and they can see very clearly what Jesus is doing wrong. "Foul!" they cry. They blow the whistle in their official capacity. "You're eating on the Sabbath. You're harvesting on the Sabbath," which is what they're accusing the disciples of doing as they grabbed grains, heads of grain off the stalks. "You're harvesting. You're working. You're defying God's law." See, what can happen, as Ray Cortez has said, who's helped me a lot with this sermon today, and as has Tim Keller and others, one of the things that can happen when you are a person who is aspiring to goodness is that you can begin to weaponize your goodness. You can weaponize your righteousness. You can use your goodness as something that is injurious for other people, as these Pharisees are doing, and you become blind to what's going on inside of you and very clear about what's going on out there. Let me give you an example. From time to time, I realize when my son on a baseball team, they're in a tournament and there are games on Sundays. The way the new tournaments work, it's unbelievable to me. It angers me. And so I do not hide it. 5 games you could play on a Sunday sometimes. And when these things happen, I think, this is evil. And I get mad. Oh, I get mad. And then I use that self-righteous indignation. What's coming out of the world today? And I get mad at the coaches and I get mad at the other parents on the team for saying, "Well, we got a game. I guess we're missing church." As if that decides everything. And I get mad. And I snarkily respond to my son who wants to play because he's not involved in my inner psychosis. And you know what's happening when I realize? I'm not really mad because I'm truly concerned that everyone's violating God's laws. I'm mad that they're putting me in an anxious position. But see, in my righteousness, I can't see that. In the moment, I know that I'm in the righteous spot, wanting to honor the Lord's day, and therefore I have right to hate everybody else who doesn't. To spew my vitriol on them. To make sideways comments about how much more important baseball is, or soccer is, or whatever is, or going out on the boat in an emergency to relax is, besides worshiping God. And it would be one thing if I was deeply concerned in those moments about the welfare of the souls of the people, or the welfare of the children, or the welfare of my relationship to God, or the profaning of our great King. But all I'm really mad about is that they're putting me in a point of decision where I might have to make an unpopular decision, and I don't want to be left out. But see, I've become the moral policeman, and I'm blind to all that stuff going on in me in the moment. And so I just get mad. But fortunately, I'm the only mad Christian there is. Okay. Is the irony apparent there? Beware if you find yourself a policeman. Beware also if you find yourself becoming a one-issue Christian. One of the things for these Pharisees is that they have made Sabbath keeping, well, they've made it a litmus test for the authenticity of the faith. If you're true Israel, we're surrounded by pagan culture, they were. We're surrounded by people who worship all kinds of gods, who worship their urges, who do whatever their bodies want to do. They do not give the living God the time of day. They don't think of him in all their thoughts. There is no room for God. And so if we're going to be the true people of God, if we're going to show that we really belong to the Lord of hosts, then we're going to keep the Sabbath. And it became, with all manner of hedges and protections and all manner of specificities, it became a day where you were being watched. If you kept it, you were in. If you didn't, you weren't true. That's why Jesus is getting picked on here. That's why his disciples are getting scrutinized. That's why Jesus is incredulous. Why? Is it more lawful to do good or evil on the Sabbath, to save life or kill? They've missed the boat, but to them, the most important thing is throwing the chairs under the table. Making sure everyone is scrupulously in line. Now, here's what can happen for us, I think. You can take a good thing, a thing that God has required, a thing that God has called the church to, and you have a particular predilection and passion for it. And then you can use that passion that God has given you, that gift that God has given you, that special burden or concern that God has given you for a certain thing. And you make it the litmus test for everybody else. And you weaponize it, and you start judging everybody around you for not caring and not being true to the faith enough because they don't match your zeal. Do you know what I'm talking about? It might be sexual purity. That's a good thing. God's into that. And that might be your whole litmus test for whether someone's in or out. It might be adoption. We got 1,000 adoptions in this congregation. It's fantastic. God loves care for orphan and widow. You make it the test. If you're a true Christian, you'll do these things. Maybe it's care of the earth. We're stewards of God's creation. If you're a true Christian, you'll do these things. Maybe it's evangelism. Maybe it's care for the poor. There's all manner of things that we can quickly lose sight of the importance of them and lose sight of the idea that our Lord, who's Lord of the Sabbath, who made it, made us, configured us with different passions and different callings, and has called his church to care about all of these things that I've mentioned, but may have given each of us individual responses and responsibilities for that. You're in danger when you become a one-issue Christian, weaponizing your righteousness, morally policing others, and using what you care about most as a criteria to judge other people. And then lastly, you've got to beware that your goodness doesn't become a disguise for distance from God. Beware that your goodness doesn't become a disguise for distance from God. Everybody looking at the Pharisees, without exception, would have said, these guys are pure gold. Stay gold, pony boy. Do you know this from outsiders? innocent, pure. Do you know the Outsiders, S.C. Hinton? Okay. Yeah. I'm about to start to cry thinking about the song at the end of the movie. They're true. They're authentic. They're good. Their righteousness is sterling. No one's better. No one's more devoted to God. No one's more adhered to God because of how scrupulously, how perfectly they keep Sabbath. There are all these laws that built up. You've heard them in other sermons, perhaps. On the Sabbath, you can take 1,100 steps. On the 1,100th and one, I'm just making up a number, you've started to go on a journey. Very specific rules about when you've moved into normal deeds of necessity, into work and harvesting. Don't spit on the ground, because if you break the soil, you may have planted. All kinds of rules and hedges and protections to make sure you don't violate the Sabbath. And on the surface, these guys would look really, really good. But we see behind their goodness that Jesus is looking at them and he is distressed at their stubborn heart. See, he's got X-ray vision. He sees beneath the surface. And here he is about to do good on the Sabbath. And the only thing they can see is that he's about to do work, healing a man with a shriveled hand. All the while, they are planning on doing evil. At the end of the story here, the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. And you could wonder aloud, does the law have any provision against the preparation of murder on the Sabbath? Is that a lawful exercise? Well, see, they didn't know. They were blind to it. But their goodness was a mask for their distance from God underneath. I've made a little jingle that you can remember when it comes to obedience, when it comes to law keeping in a right kind of way. The law kept right makes your love grow bright. I made that up. Don't you dare steal it. That's copyrighted. The law kept right makes love grow bright, but the law kept wrong makes hate grow strong. Yeah, Dr. Seuss was my great uncle. Some things that Joe Nevinson shared with me made me start thinking about this, and I've put it in a pithy little statement for you, because this is the idea. What the Pharisees were missing here, and what Jesus was trying to say when he said, the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath. He says, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. I'm the interpreter of this, and you've missed the boat. My men are hungry and in need. Just like in times of old when they went, and they were on the run from Saul, and in the place of Nob, they went to this synagogue where they ate the showbread. It was just for the priests, but there was a special provision. They were hungry and in need. This man has a shriveled hand. He's in need of restoration. And Jesus recognizes that their law keeping is not engendering love, devotion, sacrifice, and joy towards him. It's making them want to murder him. See, when you're loving God, you'll want to do what he says because you recognize that behind the law is provision, not punishment. Behind God's requirements, behind God's aspirations for us in his law, like the Sabbath, like keeping the Sabbath, knocking off from our work, is not God somehow trying to penalize us and destroy us. It's God whose heart for us is large. And so when you're rightly keeping God's law, you'll find yourself trusting him, appreciating his law, loving him. That's the fullest expression of it, because there's no divergence between law keeping and loving God and loving your neighbor. They're the same thing. They're all one thing. But when you keep the law as a way to keep Jesus away, when you keep the law as a way to disguise your distance from God, then what you're going to find is a secret suspicion of God. I haven't used the Seinfeld reference in a long time, I don't think. So I'll do one now. You know George Costanza. Well, George Costanza, in one episode that I love, is driving along. He's got his girlfriend on the front seat of his car. And he drives, and there in the middle of the road is a pigeon. Well, so what normally happens is you're driving, you don't stop for a pigeon. The sort of implication is that the pigeon will fly off just in time. That's what George was counting on. That's what you and I count on. So he's driving along, and the pigeon does not move, and so George decapitates it. His girlfriend thinks him a monster, and he is filled with self-recrimination and self-justification. "We had a deal," he says. And he goes on waxing eloquently about this implied arrangement in nature between pigeons and humans. "We let you live in the cities with us. We let you get on our roads, but then when we're coming, you have to leave. You fly away. We don't stop for you. You fly away." And George cannot stand it that he did what he was supposed to do, and the pigeon did not keep up his end of the bargain. And he kept saying, "We had a deal. We had a deal." Implied consent from a pigeon. And it's easy to start thinking if your obedience to God, your goodness, is somehow not growing you in love for God, or you don't see the love behind the law, then probably what's going to happen is you're going to feel yourself going, "But we had a deal, God. I was supposed to go to church and tithe and be good and vote Republican, all that stuff that you require. And then you were supposed to be nice to me. But we had a deal and you're not being nice to me. What's wrong with you?" See, love, laws kept right make your love grow bright, but law kept wrong makes your hate grow strong. I had a friend in high school, my best buddy growing up, and I can remember staying at his house. I was probably a senior, after our senior in high school, his parents were gone. And my friend, he had the audacity. He could do this. It was unbelievable. I can't believe the injustice of this, the crime of this. When he got tired, you know what he could do? He could go to bed. He'd just go to bed. He would just, right there, he'd just go to bed. And you know what he would not do? He wouldn't fiddle with anything else. There were TVs on, stoves on, if there was a fire in the fireplace, if all the doors in the house were open and there were animals unfed, he didn't care. He'd just go to bed. And so he'd go to bed, and I can remember fuming around his house where I was staying. I'm 18 years old, 17 years old, turning off TVs, closing and locking the doors, making sure the dryer's off, folding the clothes. Not really. And all the while I'm murmuring about this. I'm not happy that I'm serving my friend and protecting his house. I'm angry that he has the audacity to be able to rest. And I could look at him and I could say, "What's wrong with you, man?" And he would more rightly look at me and say, "No. What is wrong with you, man?" See, my problem was a kind of responsibility disorder, and I was trying to do what I thought was right, and I was using it as a weapon. And it was making me his policeman. It was making me not love him or God or anybody. It was making me feel like a martyr. And I was angry at him because he didn't feel the same burden inside. And my hate was growing strong. Jesus' anger is aimed at the most ardent Sabbath keepers. But that doesn't mean that Jesus is anti-Sabbath. It means that he wants you to see it as a gift. And here's the second point, which sounds like I just made like 16. The gift of Sabbath is restoration. That's what Jesus wants these guys to see. That's what you see in the healing of the man with the shriveled hand. That's what you see in a couple of chapters earlier where Jesus commands a man with an evil spirit to come out of him on the Sabbath. That's why he's making the argument. There's a special case here. My disciples are hungry and they're in need. So they ate. They're not violating the Sabbath. The Sabbath is for people. You could argue that Jesus thought the Sabbath was way more important than the Pharisees did. Because he knew what it was for. He made it. He knew it was a gift for us. It was a gift of God for rest, for replenishment, and fulfillment. A gift of God for rest, replenishment, and fulfillment. It's, as the Heidelberg Catechism calls it, a festive day of rest. It's a day when not only when God says, you shall not work, it's a day when God says, you don't have to work. And one of my great favorite letters of C.S. Lewis to an American lady that he had correspondence with for many years, she is complaining in one of the letters about being sick and therefore unable to work, unable to do things. And I love his response to her. He says, you know, I guess this is a man and woman thing, because for men, and maybe this is sexist, he's talking about himself, but it resonates with me. He says, for men, one of the only consolations about being sick is that at least no one can expect you to do anything. I'm off the hook. I'm sick. No man say, man, I wish I could go do some things and have more responsibilities. I'm sick. I'm free. For at least 24 hours, hopefully 36. It's God's snow day. Do you know we've had some snow days recently? One of the great privileges of the snow day is that it's so universal in an area that no matter what you were worried about or what you thought needed to happen, whatever you were stressing over, God just shuts everything down. It's the one area still, the weather, where we can't fully control it and be under the illusion that we are masters of our own fate and authors of our best hope. And so God lets the rains fall and the ice over and then turns to snow and the winter wonderland comes and everybody has to take a break. And Jesus says, this gift of Sabbath is like a snow day every 6 days for the people of God. They get to rest. They don't have to work. They shouldn't work. They rest. They get refreshed. They get replenished. A few months ago, after the service, the Dorsis kids came up to me, and I can't remember which one. There's like 30 of them. They're not here. They're normally right there. He must be on call this weekend. And one of their kids came up to me and said, Pastor Eric, you know, pulling on my leg or something. Pastor Eric, on Sundays, we are not allowed to eat vegetables. And I said, what? He said, yeah, on Sundays we're not allowed to eat vegetables. We have cake and Coke and whiskey and cigars. And okay, he didn't say that. Don't tell his parents that. But see, they had purposefully made a practice in their home of trying to help the kids see that the Lord's Day is a day of celebration. It's not a day for no smiling. It's not a day of God punishing you. It's a day of joy where God says, you don't have to do all your normal stuff. You don't have to work. You don't have to be concerned about everything in the world. Leave it to me. Have some cake. A festive day of rest. And it's also a day that keeps you whole and from the affliction of God neglect. One author has said that Jews kept the Sabbath and the Sabbath kept the Jews. This is the same way marriage works. Dietrich Bonhoeffer in one place said, now your love has led you to take these vows, but now your vows will keep the love. There's this recognition that our internal realities are shaped and held by external practices, and our external practices shape our internal realities. And so the practice of the Sabbath really does, taking a day off really does, help keep us. It helps make sure we're not living entirely in God neglect, which is very easy to do. You know, one of the things that happens to addicts, people who are addicted to things, maybe you've been addicted to something, is when you're addicted to something, you're always saying, well, tomorrow I'll do different. Or if someone calls you on it, you'll say, I can quit anytime. If you're not aware of your problem, I can quit this anytime. Of course, the obvious next question or the next request is from the person, well, then how about you do that now? Oh, why would I do that? I can quit anytime. This has got no hold on me. Why would I need to take drastic measures? To take a day off each seven is a way of reminding us, do we follow the Lord of the Sabbath? Is he really our Lord? Is he really calling the shots? Is he really the one we're looking toward? Or do we have other masters? Have we unwittingly become people who merely see ourselves as consumers or performers, as people whose sole goal in life is to make a name for themselves or to have good hair? That sounds silly, doesn't it? Everybody can't have hair like this. Just kidding. On the Sabbath, you stop and you say, wait, the Lord of heaven and earth who made the Sabbath, he made me. My life is more important than my work. Who I am is more than what I make. I belong to him. It's a way of weaning us off our addictive behaviors, addicted on the praise and the success and even the busyness and adrenaline that comes that makes us feel like something. Surely, says Tim Kreider, surely when we're busy, when we're on calls 24/7, our existence can't be meaningless. We have to mean something, right? If things are required of us and we can never stop. And so it weans us off all that addiction to say, no, 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 no. My master is the master of mercy who has given me this one day of rest in a wearisome world, where I can come to worship with God's people and get recalibrated, rehinged when the doors are falling off, as one author said, and remind myself whose I am, who I trust, who empowers me, whose image I bear. And you know the other thing it does, this gift of rest and fulfillment, the gift that keeps you, this gift also gives you time to pay attention to the kinds of things that you can't quantify with money but might be more valuable than it. That's an easy sentence. Would you like me to repeat it? This gift gives you time to pay attention to things that you can't really quantify with money, but might be more valuable than money. Wendell Berry in one place says this. He talks about Athy, this old man who has this kind of tenderness. And he's always, when he walks through town, he always talks to children and to people who are forgotten. And he talks to the stray dogs, has a special kind of affection for the people that other people don't notice. And then Barry writes this about him. It was the tenderness of a man who had been busy all his life, but now had the time to pay attention to useless things. He had the time to pay attention to useless things. And of course, useless, we'll put in air quotes. Useless things that can't make you any money. Useless things that might not increase your fame or acclaim in the world, that might not validate you as a person, but which humanize you, which remind you what you're for. Time with your children, unhurried, unscheduled time with your family, with your worship family. Eating over a meal, singing together, laughing together. Love and hurry, says John Ortberg, are incompatible. See, the thing that love most demands is time. And people in a hurry, that's the thing they don't have any of. And so God, knowing that we're people who'll get cattywampus with our priorities and cattywampus with our perspectives and sideways in recognizing and remembering what we're for, gives us this day to remember widows and orphans, to remember our own kids, to remember our spouses, to remember our friends, and have the time to not rush through caring for them, to be with them without an agenda. The gift of Sabbath is this restoration. It's a festive day of rest that keeps you. It weans you off your addictions and it helps you pay attention to useless things. And the requirement of the Sabbath is simple. It's trust. Dave Hansen says, we argue against the Sabbath command more than all the rest. The second you say, 6 days you shall do all your work, and on the seventh you shall rest. Honor the Sabbath by keeping it holy. The first question we ask is not, wow, what is behind this amazing provision where we don't have to work? The first question we ask is, am I allowed to eat ice cream on the Sabbath? Can I play in a baseball game on the Sabbath? Am I allowed to do my homework on the Sabbath? Am I allowed to get prepared for a meeting on Monday morning on the Sabbath? What am I allowed to go out to eat on the Sabbath? If that's the first thing you ask, then you've missed the boat. That's what we're trying to say. One of the things that you have to do. See, the author of Hebrews talks about Sabbath like this. You know, Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath. He restores the man as a kind of sneak preview for the coming attractions. There is this cosmic day of rest where we will strive no more, where there will be no more shriveled hands and no more inflamed elbows, tennis elbow, when all shall be well, all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. And on Sundays, we anticipate that. But in order to anticipate that, in order to anticipate that very truly, Jesus has worked to fulfill all of God's commands for us, and he has been punished to take away all God's displeasure against us, to welcome us into a new universe, to have the gift of eternal life, to show that we trust that, we have to say, if I trust him with eternity, do I trust him with next Tuesday? If I trust him to see me through the grave to resurrection, can I trust him for a day without working? It's very unlikely that you can really trust God with your salvation, that it's a free gift if you can't trust him for one day to give up your work or whatever you think is important. It's a day when we say, everything depends on the replenishing, the restoration of God, the Lord of the Sabbath. I trust him. So we've seen Jesus' anger at ardent Sabbath keepers. That laws kept right make love grow bright. Laws kept wrong make hate grow strong. That the gift of Sabbath, there's a gift behind it. It's restoration, it's rest and fulfillment. It keeps us in allegiance and an antidote to God neglect. And the requirement of Sabbath is trust. You have to trust him to be able to knock off of your work. You have to trust him to go to bed at night. You have to trust him. And I'll close with this. There's a story that Garrison Keillor tells in his Lake Wobegon Tales about all the people that descend on Lake Wobegon at Christmas time and they make their way back to church. Maybe they haven't come any at all during the year. And some go to listen to Father Emil at the Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility. And others, that's a funny name of a church. And others go to Lake Wobegon Lutheran Church. And at Lake Wobegon Lutheran Church, there's Larry Sorensen. Larry the sad boy, he's called. And he was there at that Christmas, and he had been saved 12 times in the Lutheran Church, an all-time record. Between 1953 and 1961, he threw himself weeping and contrite on God's throne of grace on 12 separate occasions. And this in a Lutheran church that wasn't evangelical. They had no altar call. They had no organist playing Just As I Am without one plea while a choir hummed. And a guy with shiny hair took hold of your heartstrings and played you like a cheap guitar. This was the Lutheran church. Not a bunch of hillbillies. These are Scandinavians. And they repent in the same way that they sin. Discreetly. Tastefully, at the proper time, and they bring a jello salad afterward. But Larry Sorensen came forward, weeping buckets, and crumpled up at the communion rail to the amazement of the minister who had just delivered a dry sermon about stewardship. And now he had to put his arms around this limp and soggy individual and pray with him and see if he had a way to get home. 12 times. Even the fundamentalists got tired of him, Keillor says. Granted, we're born in original sin and we're worthless and we're vile, but 12 conversions is too many. God didn't mean us to feel guilt all our lives. There comes a point when you dry your tears and you join the building committee. You start grappling with the problems of the church furnace and the church roof. And you make church coffee, and you be of use. But Larry kept on repenting and repenting and repenting. It seems to me that one of the best gifts for people who want to take God seriously, like many of us here, one of the best gifts of the Sabbath is the day where we keep on repenting. But not in a way that we're just eaten up with ourselves, but in a way where we recognize, oh, wait. Once again, I've forgotten what I'm about. Once again, I've forgotten who I trust. But once again, God has made this provision for me to remind me that I serve the Lord of the Sabbath, who's kept all the Sabbaths perfectly, so I don't have to keep it in nervousness, who's succeeded in every single place that I've failed, so I don't have to watchfully and scrupulously, nervously walk around my life as if I'm about to mess up and God's going to pull the trap door. And I get to take this as a gift, this gift of reminding me that God doesn't want me to have to work my fingers to the bone. He cares about the shriveled places, the gnarled places, the places that need recuperation. So he's built it in one day in seven to give me a foretaste of what's coming, a new earth that he'll win us access to, and a new day tomorrow where we've received mercy. That we've weaponized our righteousness, that we failed God in many ways, we've received mercy from the Christ who's taken all away from us. So we go out into the world to offer the rest we got to everybody else. Just like Jesus said, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy burdened, and I'll give you rest. We have rest to receive each day, really. And we have rest to offer. I hope we'll do it.